Macron has failed in his mediations because he and Germany have not been able to convince Ukraine to respect the Minsk agreements. If Macron had been able to convince Ukraine of this, then things could have been quite different. France should have been able to achieve this, but the United States obviously didn't want it.
Since 2014, some 14,000 people have been killed in Ukraine. Russia's offensive on February 24th has produced almost 500 civilian deaths and nearly 2 million refugees, according to the United Nations. In recent years, many politicians have argued that the European Union is necessary in order to have peace on the continent. However, forming an EU army, sending arms within Europe, and waging a sanctions war, which is sure to hurt the Russian people, doesn't seem peaceful to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Members of Iran's Assembly of Experts have held their second biannual meeting this year. That's the ninth official session of the current assembly, which was elected in 2016.
Members of the Assembly of Experts convene twice a year to review the latest domestic and global issues. This time, Ebrahim Raisi, who's one of the Assembly's members, has participated as Iran's president.
Raisi was invited to highlight his administration's achievements and review the challenges it faces. During this session, Chairman of the Assembly of Experts, Ahmad Jannati, urged President Raisi to take practical steps to address the economic problems of Iranians and improve their livelihood.
We need to improve the livelihood of the less privileged strata. The Honorable President must take steps to make this happen. I hope other members of this cabinet follow suit and help the needy have a better life. This is the least we should do as a duty.
The Assembly of Experts was established in 1983, almost 4 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Its main task is to monitor the performance of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. The experts should also elect a new leader in the event of the demise, resignation, or dismissal of the current leader.
The Assembly of Experts was the entity that elected Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei as the new leader after Imam Khomeini passed away in 1988. Not only does it supervise the performance of the leader, but it plays a crucial role in protecting the political establishment.
The Assembly of Experts is currently a body of 88 Islamic jurists. The entity consists of a leadership council and six committees. Members are elected by direct public vote for an 8-year term. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians rallied on Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to drum up support for thousands of prisoners held in Israeli jails. Their solidarity action comes as around 450 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for their military court hearings for the third month in a row. Administrative detainees are denied due process, and their detention orders can be renewed for indefinite periods of time.
For the third month, the Palestinian administrative detainees are boycotting the Israeli military courts in order to protest the administrative detention. And now the Palestinian detainees need all kinds of support by the Palestinian community and the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are also subject to torture and psychological pressure by the Israeli prison authorities, including daily raids and solitary confinement. Currently, some 5,000 Palestinians are languishing inside Israeli jails, including minors and women.
The Israeli administration, they conducted series of attacks and aggression against prisoners, especially women. This gathering asking international community to put pressure to Israeli government in order to facilitate their rights and stop the aggression against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners regularly stage hunger strikes in protest against both the administrative detention policy and harsh detention conditions. Prisoners' advocacy groups have raised the alarm over the inhumane conditions inside Israeli jails.
Nowadays, the situation is going to explode inside Israeli prisons because of the Israeli measures that aimed to break the will of Palestinian detainees and to confiscate their rights.
Experts say Palestinian prisoners will continue to suffer inside Israeli jails as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights. Statistics by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Joint statement by the diplomatic missions of the Western countries in Islamabad has created an uproar in Pakistan. The statement posted on the social media platforms presses Pakistan to condemn Russia. The statement was signed by the envoys of European countries and endorsed by the US embassy in Islamabad.
The move by the Western diplomatic missions here has drawn strong reaction from the Pakistani government. The Foreign Office has summoned the envoys of the Western countries to tell them that issuing public statements against the host country is not in line with the diplomatic protocols.
On Sunday, Prime Minister Imran Khan doubled down on the European ambassadors and made it clear that Pakistan is not their slave.
I want to ask the European ambassadors, did you write such a letter to India? What do you think of us? Are we your slaves? That whatever you say, we will do.
Pakistan has maintained a fine balance in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The reason Pakistan refused to condemn Russia stems from its growing ties with Moscow.
But the only thing that I can say from Pakistan's government perspective that Pakistan wants de-escalation. Honestly, Pakistan wants end of the war or end of bombing or end of aggression anywhere for that matter in the world.
Pakistan has remained in the Western camp for decades, but now wants to diversify its foreign policy options. It was because of this reason that despite pressure from the West, Pakistan abstained from the voting on a resolution against Russia at the UN General Assembly session. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
In the limelight.
In a report presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council recently, David Boyd, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, says pollution contributed to twice as many premature deaths as COVID-19 in the first 18 months of the coronavirus pandemic. We now present you an article written by Damien Gale. The piece is titled, UN Expert Warns Millions Suffering in Deadly Pollution Sacrifice Zones. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. United Nations expert has warned of the creation of pollution sacrifice zones across the world, where tens of millions of people are suffering strokes, cancers, respiratory problems and heart disease as a result of toxic contamination of the environment. David Boyd, a United Nations expert, told The Guardian, "There are sacrifice zones all over the world, in every region, in the north, in the south, in the east and the west, in rich countries and in poor countries." David Boyd, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, cited physical health issues, including cancer, heart disease, respiratory illness, strokes, and reproductive health problems, as well as incredible mental health problems associated with living in these places because people feel exploited and they feel stigmatized. David Boyd said, "All of this infringed their human rights, their rights to life and their rights to health, and their right to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment." He added, "You cannot reconcile that fundamental right to a healthy environment with these absolutely horrific environmental conditions." In a report presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council recently, David Boyd says pollution contributed to twice as many premature deaths as COVID-19 pandemic in the first 18 months of the pandemic. Giving the death toll from pollution in that period is a staggering 9 million people, the report adds. One in six deaths in the world involves diseases caused by pollution, three times more than deaths from AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis combined, and 15 times more than from all wars, murders and other forms of violence. David Boyd's report warns the toxification of planet Earth is intensifying, pointing out that even as some harmful chemicals are banned or abandoned, overall production of chemicals doubled between 2000 and 2017 and will double again by 2030. And while everyone was affected to some degree, some communities were being hit far more than others. David Boyd told The Guardian, "If you look at these places that I've highlighted in my report, pollution on our planet today is pervasive. It's affecting everyone, but it's affecting some people in a really grossly unfair and disproportionate way," he said. The United States, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, one of the wealthiest countries in all of human history, is home to one of the worst sacrifice zones on the planet. This place is called Cancer Alley in Louisiana, where there are more than 100 oil refineries, petrochemical plants, etc. David Boyd added, and guess where they're located? In poor, predominantly black communities in Louisiana. It's just as I said, it's unconscionable. Other sacrifice zones include Kabwe in Zambia, where 95% of children had elevated levels of lead in their blood, putting them at risk of lifelong intellectual impairment. The Patarat landfill in Romania, where thousands of Roma people live and are exposed to arsenic, lead, mercury and other pollutants. The French overseas territories of Guadeloupe and Martinique in the Caribbean, where 90% of people were found to have the carcinogenic pesticide chlorodicone in their blood. David Boyd said businesses were the main culprit, with most happy to overlook social and environmental costs in favour of their bottom line, adding that money was the main barrier to addressing the climate crisis, to addressing biodiversity loss, and to addressing pervasive pollution. He called on governments around the world to impose strong regulation on corporations causing pollution and to stop spending an estimated $1.8 trillion a year on subsidies for environmentally damaging industries. David Boyd said oil and gas companies are not going to voluntarily stop producing oil and gas. Big coal companies are not going to voluntarily shift from being big coal companies to being big solar and wind companies. Governments have to do that. That's their job. It's governments that have the obligations to respect, to protect and fulfill our human rights. But, he said, there was cause for optimism. David Boyd's report comes 6 months after the Human Rights Council recognised for the first time that everyone had a human right to live in a clean, healthy and sustainable environment. He said, and this is really a key point, previous agreements on biodiversity and climate change and pollution were formally unenforceable. But guess what? When you weld the international environmental agreements together with human rights law brings into the equation institutions, processes and accountability. David Boyd added, that's what's really exciting about this United Nations recognition of a right to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment. It signals this union of human rights law and environmental law, which can be an extremely powerful catalyst of the kinds of transformative changes that we so desperately need.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Vienna talks between Iran and the P4 plus one group of countries over the revival of the JCPOA have been paused at the request of the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, who tweeted that a final text is essentially ready and on the table and proposed a temporary halt to the talks due to what he called external factors. Iran says the pause can provide a momentum for resolving the remaining issues and a final return to the negotiations, adding that no external factor can affect the parties' joint will to go forward for a collective agreement. Iran has time and again stressed that Washington needs to make a political decision to ensure that Tehran's basic demands are met. To get further details on the decision by the EU foreign policy chief, we're now joined by our correspondent, Homa Lezgi, who's with us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Homa, what does this pause mean?
Yes, Pardio. So today I think we heard a lot. We heard the comments from the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, when he addressed reporters and delivered a kind of statement saying, again, that this is because of external factors, as Mr. Josep Borrell said, and we are going into these pause with a hope that we can come back, he said, within days. That's the hope, which was also voiced by the Chinese ambassador when he talked to the media, that they can come back and get this done. Now, what we're hearing is I'd like to point out the comment made by the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Ulyanov. He said that he wants to make it clear that Russia is not the sole party on whose decision the conclusion of the talks depends. He said that he wants to stress on this fact that there are lots of players involved here. It's not just Russia. Russia is only one of the participants of these negotiations. There are the interests of various parties, and there are issues that are related specifically between Iran and the U.S. and fall into that context and need to be settled between them. And he was saying, basically, you should not assume that the future or fate of these talks and their conclusion depends solely on Russia and Russia's decisions. I'd just like to also point out to a tweet from the UK representative, lead delegate in the talks. She said that she believes a fair and comprehensive deal is on the table, is ready for conclusion, and that the Iran and the US have worked hard to resolve their issues, and that the E3, in her words, are ready to conclude these talks now. However, the external factors, in her words, must be resolved in the next few days if we want to make that happen. But this is the position that the Europeans have been giving, both, I think, Americans in various briefings that they've had, and also sources close to the Iranian team, however, have been saying that there are still unresolved issues between Iran and America when it comes to the scope of sanctions that need to be removed, and some other issues related to, for instance, economic guarantees, etc. What we are hearing, though, that despite these differences, they're not difficult to overcome. They can be overcome quickly if this pause creates a time for various parties to have the necessary consultations for the Russians, Americans, and the Iranians specifically to come up with the decisions that need to be taken, then the negotiations can conclude successfully.
All right, thanks a lot. Homa Lezgi joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Well, joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have journalist Abbas Aslani, who's with us also from the Austrian capital, Vienna. And we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Abbas Aslani in Vienna. Mr. Aslani, it's great to have you with us. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, suggested a temporary halt to the talks due to what he called external factors, one being Russia requesting guarantees for civilian nuclear projects related to the JCPOA that they will not be affected by Washington sanctions on Moscow. How do you perceive this recess in the negotiations? And how critical of a phase have the revival negotiations reached right now?
Well, thank you for having me. In fact, the talks have reached a stage which is very close to an agreement, but they have not been able to make it. In order to finalize the text of an agreement, it seems that all the participants to the deal need to somehow find a common ground. You know, there are two sets of issues. One is that the U.S. has been lengthening the process by not, let's say, trying to abide by the lifting of the sanctions that it is supposed to lift in accordance with the JCPOA. Yesterday, Iranian foreign minister was referring to, let's say, the different and frequent changes in the messages that the U.S. has been communicating to Iran via the Joint Commission Coordinator. And they have been arguing that due to the public opinion pressure in the United States, they cannot make the decision on lifting the sanctions. So in that case, Iran will not have motivation to return to the full compliance with the nuclear deal, because Iran's, let's say, main reason to make the deal has been to economically benefit from the JCPOA. So one issue is related to the sanctions and the scope of sanctions and the quality of lifting those sanctions as well. As one senior European diplomat put forth today, was that they will have some further discussions and negotiations over the picture of how those sanctions need to be lifted. But on the other hand, recently we have been hearing some, let's say, remarks by Russian officials on receiving a written guarantee from the Western parties that the current and future EU and US sanctions, meaning over Ukraine, will not impact Russia's relations with Iran. That's why we are hearing that the European officials, as well as the American ones, they are referring to that demand as an external factor. They say that the Russian position is irrelevant to the JCPOA, and they cannot, let's say, ensure that the Iran's bilateral relations with other countries, or can be guaranteed. But you know, the Russian argument that the other sanctions must not impact, let's say, relations with Iran when it comes to economy or nuclear cooperation.
Okay.
That's correct. But also on the other side, we have the U.S., let's say, lack of decision on lifting the sanctions. What is important that is to return to the, let's say, terms of the deal based on the text of the original deal, as well as the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231.
Sure.
And I think this can be maybe the perspective that has been important to Iran.
Let's bring in Mr. John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade. Mr. Bosnich, Iran says that Russia's request can bring a new topic to the agenda of the talks as an unanticipated component, but the main obstacle to the negotiations is the lack of a U.S. political decision to accept Iran's demands. What do you think is the main obstacle in the way of an agreement?
The U.S. government is in a state of semi-paralysis now because of the conflict in Ukraine, and this is perhaps the best example of where Biden's difficulty in keeping up to date on government affairs is crippling the U.S. operations. I would expect that during the crisis in Ukraine, the United States is going to try to buy time, because the last thing they want to do now is add another confrontation and another problem to their plate. I expect that you should see the United States delegation delaying, trying to buy time, and trying to slow down the entire process for at least the next 3 weeks.
Mr. Aslani, a major question here is what assurances can be given that another U.S. administration doesn't come along and leave the deal again, just like the Donald Trump administration did, basically asking, should the U.S. or can the U.S. be trusted?
Well, there have been different discussions on different types of guarantees that can be given to Iran. However, the American administration have been resisting, against giving those guarantees. Earlier discussions were made on, presenting political, guarantees, we have also had discussions on economic guarantees as well as the legal ones. For example, there have been examples on, what the Congress can do. It's somehow difficult to imagine that they would give a guarantee, but on economic ones, that if in case, any U.S. administration leaves the deal, the companies will have a period of time to be able to somehow to prepare their departure, or giving some announcements politically that they won't leave the deal. But one of the most important, guarantees can be inherent guarantees, which is in fact the reversibility of Iran's nuclear potential and program. Meaning that can work as a potential leverage, that in case any party, most specifically the United States, leaves the deal, Iran can return and resume its nuclear activities at the earliest time and as quick as possible. So this could be more, practical guarantee. There has been discussions on that. Some relative progress has been made. But it seems that, the Americans, they have not been able to serious actions vis-a-vis this issue. We have to see till the end that to see what is the, actual guarantees that are provided by a likely agreement. But I would say that the inherent guarantee can be the most important one, which can be followed by, accompanied by economic guarantees as well as the political one.
John Bosnich, an analyst we spoke to here on Press TV, said that Tehran believes the U.S. wants to keep parts of the sanctions in place in order to use them as leverage to draw concessions from Iran
over its regional influence and military capabilities. Do you see it in that light as well?
Absolutely. That is standard U.S. policy. The United States considers itself to be literally above the law. And when they enter into negotiations on any topic, they then have a kind of a strategy meeting in Washington in which they determine what other factors could be brought to bear. And that covers all forms of trade, that covers transportation, that covers regional communications and information transfer. So Iran has been targeted for years by the United States. The United States does not want to be friends with Iran, and the reason for this is because the U.S. policy towards Iran is largely governed by the Israel lobby in Washington. And Israel has as an objective the sidelining and the weakening of Iran. If Iran is allowed to have a good, solid nuclear energy program, it works against the interests of Israel as a regional hegemon, and therefore against the interests of America as the global hegemon.
Mr. Aslani, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says that Iran will not budge over its regional presence or its nuclear progress vis-a-vis the United States or any other power simply to protect itself against sanctions. If you may unpack those comments for us.
Well, Iran's influence or presence in the region has been a source of power for the country, and this power has, let's say, created a deterrence for the country in order to deter some likely invasions against Iran, as well as it has, if that has deterred any invasions against the country, it means that it has been a cause for established peace and security in the region as well. Because if there is any war in the region, this can, let's say, bring damages to other parts of the region. This can be a fire. This can put region maybe on fire. So if these, let's say, potentials and these this deterrence has stopped a likely war, so this is in benefit of Iran, and this is also, let's say, this can benefit the region as well. On the other hand, you know, it is said that the U.S. as well as the West has been trying all along, from the past till now, to keep some sanctions in place in order to not to let Iran to benefit from the lifting of the sanctions. So the benefit Iran can enjoy can be partial. So those remaining sanctions or the structure of the sanctions, if kept in place, they can be used as a leverage for future negotiations or talks on region, on Iran's missile capability, and other areas as well. So that's why if Iran, let's say, makes compromises on its regional issues, on its defense capabilities, this will empty Iran's hands in any negotiations, even in the nuclear negotiations that are taking place. So Iran wants to make sure that it has its own tools in its foreign policy toolbox, as well as, let's say, the power to protect itself against the foreign pressure. So that's why Iranian leader, I think, is emphasizing on the importance of the Iran's presence in the region as a source of national power and as a source of, let's say, deterrence in the region. And this can be a source for peace and stability as well for Iran and the region itself.
John Bosnich, on that note, according to the leader, the U.S. propositions that Iran needs to reduce its defense power as to not provoke the enemies are extremely naive and amateurish. He said such ideas have been raised in the past but turned down every time. Ayatollah Khamenei said it would be a grave mistake for Iran to back down on its stance and it would hurt Tehran's political power. The question is, why is such a request even on the table from the United States and its allies?
That's very simple. The United States is the global bully. They pretend to be the global policeman, but actually they are a global bully. And the United States operates a protection racket, where if you come to terms with the United States, they give you some minimal ability to survive, but they make sure that you don't become independent of them, and they make sure that all of your business has to go in a manner that they can monitor and control it. I believe, and I believe most political advisors and most political analysts would say that Iran is playing the exactly right game here by standing by its sovereignty, by pointing out that the United States is no longer in the position to swing its might around, especially with the situation in Ukraine. And this may provide Iran an opportunity to finally escape from what is in effect international blackmail by the United States.
Abbas Aslani, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, believes that the Vienna talks are becoming more complicated by the hour because the U.S. is actually refraining from making a political decision. Is Washington serious, in your opinion, or does it have ulterior motives regarding the revival of the deal?
Well, Americans, they have been, claiming to clinch a deal as soon as possible, and they have been demanding Iran and other parties to do so. But in action, what we have been seeing that they have been, protracting the process by somehow changing their messages, changing their stances, or at least not being very active in giving the initiatives or proposals at the table. And this indicates that they have not been able to somehow contribute to the process as they were expected to. So as the time goes on, the negotiations can be more complicated, you know, because there are other, developments happening in the world. And maybe one of the issues that we are seeing a Russian demand in the negotiations, which is another issue at the table, is due to the new developments that are evolving and are taking place in the world. So there is no guarantee that we won't have new developments or new situation in the region, globally. And that's why I think it can be more complicated. And in the course of the negotiations, not only we do not see any, good faith from the American side, but look what happened just recently, that Americans seized an Iranian ship, and this contradicts with what is said at the negotiating table. You know, exactly they do the opposite thing that they are supposed to do. They are seizing Iranian ship, but in action they are supposed, and in practice they are supposed to, lift the sanctions. You know, the words and the deeds do not agree. So, and that's why it is said that maybe the U.S. is not that much serious. And if they want to reach an agreement, First, they have to be ready to, to return to the full compliance with all terms of the nuclear deal. And their, actions must meet their words in practice as well.
And one last question for Mr. Bozich before we wrap up the show. How would you rate Europe's performance regarding the JCPOA and its revival? For example, their initial commitments, their stance on the U.S. abruptly leaving the deal, have the Europeans held up their end in all of this?
The best word to use to describe them in the English language is spineless. They've shown zero backbone, they've shown zero sovereignty, and they've shown zero solidarity with the entire concept of a fair-based negotiations towards a mutually acceptable agreement. I can say that the Europeans in this particular negotiations and in general have shown that they are merely just following instructions from Washington, and they have disgraced themselves in these talks. And I think that Iran has done an excellent job in presenting its case clearly and defending its stance and its sovereignty. If you stay the course, your results will be much, much better than if you cave in.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist Abbas Aslani joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna, and also thanks to journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade, and a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
In the limelight.
U.S. officials claim the military aims for net zero carbon emissions by 2050, but with a carbon footprint greater than some 140 countries, critics say it needs radical change. We're prepared for you an article written by Ife Kuchlu. The piece is titled, Is Superpolluting Pentagon's Climate Plan Just Military-Grade Greenwash? U.S. military, an institution whose carbon footprint exceeds that of nearly 140 countries, claims it wants to go green. On 8th of February this year, the U.S. Army released its climate strategy. Among other tactics, officials claim the Army aims for net zero emissions by 2050, to electrify its combat and non-tactical vehicles, to power its bases with carbon-free electricity, and to develop clean global supply chains. Wars are extreme polluters, and while the Army's purported plan would significantly reduce its greenhouse gas emissions, experts say it does not do nearly enough. David Vine, a professor of political anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., said, "The Department of Defense, the entity that is the U.S. war machine, is the largest institutional contributor to global warming on planet Earth." Professor David Vine added, "And the military does not acknowledge that. It does at least state that there is a need to reduce its impact on the planet. For example, the Army Climate Strategy admits that the U.S. Army's nearly $740 million yearly expenditure on electricity created 4.1 million tons of greenhouse gases in 2020, 1 million tons more than the greenhouse gas emissions generated by Switzerland's heat and electricity sector in 2017. Although the U.S. Army's climate strategy is reflective of the Pentagon's stance on the climate crisis, which it has identified as a security threat, critics say the plan misses out on several crucial details. Doug Weir, research and policy director at the Conflict and Environment Observatory, said, "It lacks accountability mechanisms, for one thing," adding, "We need to ensure that scrutiny mechanisms are in place, otherwise it's just military-grade greenwash." For example, the U.S. military and the U.S. Army do not report their fuel usage to Congress, let alone itemize how much fuel was spent where or on what war. Most U.S. government accounting of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions omit figures on how much the military contributes, even via a relatively easy-to-track measure like fuel consumption. And consume fuel it certainly does in vast quantities. A 2019 report found that the Department of Defense is not only the largest consumer of energy in the United States, but is also the world's largest institutional consumer of petroleum, and thus the world's largest institutional emitter of greenhouse gases. Between 2001 and 2017, the Department of Defense was responsible for emitting 1.2 billion metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, equivalent to the annual emissions of 257 million cars. This year, it is expected to burn through 82.3 million barrels of fuel, more than the total oil consumption of Finland. Netta Crawford, political scientist and co-director of Brown University's Costs of War project, said, "The plan aims to supposedly reduce this number, but a more impactful way for the US military to address the scale and pace of its carbon footprint is to simply do less." She points to the fact that the US military has about 800 installations in 80 countries and another 740 military bases on home soil, of which about 315 are army installations. Yet by its own admission, the Pentagon says the US Army operates a third more bases than it needs. It calls this excess basing capacity. Professor David Vine said, "Far greater savings can be achieved by just closing a base rather than making a base that is unnecessary more energy efficient. Even that kind of thinking would probably not be enough to reduce the armed forces' greenhouse gas emissions as much as is needed, however." Stephen Smith, coordinator at the UN Environment Programme's Disasters and Conflict subprogram, said, "The military's climate impact is not just about the environmental footprint of the military itself. It's also about the way the operations are conducted and the way wars are fought." Stephen Smith added, "War is, by its nature, destructive." For instance, post-war construction uses up a vast amount of resources. According to Hassan Parto, a UN Environment Programme manager, the disposal of rubble and rebuilding from infrastructure destruction is a long, carbon-intensive process. Referring to cleanups that were required in Iraq, Hassan Parto said, "The amount of trucking and emissions that would be required to dispose of this debris is like traveling from the Earth to the Moon multiple times. War also degrades land, altering and reducing its carbon sequestration capacity." Ware said, "The land degradation legacy in Iraq shows that when you change the land and change the soils, that changes the amount of carbon it can store. To what extent is unclear, as it is rarely, if ever, studied. But soil erosion causes carbon loss, and desertification and degradation reduce land's ability to hold carbon, all of which probably happened in Iraq, particularly in what was once marshland." Weir said, "We know so little about how much land is destroyed in this matter," adding, "No one's really following or documenting it." He thinks an even larger contributor to the climate crisis than the emissions caused by fighting is the environmental changes those conflicts create. Of course, the fighting doesn't help. Hassan Parto says some of the first targets in conflict zones are oil infrastructure and electricity-generating power plants. The US military has frequently targeted oil tankers in Syria. The resulting fires give rise to heavy carbon emissions. Hassan Parto added, "In the case of Iraq, people could not see the sun from all the emissions. US emissions rose dramatically following the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan." But even non-violent conflict triggers other carbon emissions. Netta Crawford, political scientist and co-director of Brown University's Cost of War Project, said, "When the United States acts to increase its presence in Asia and the Pacific, it alerts the Chinese to the American presence, and they respond by making more weapons, which in turn produce more carbon emissions. But what can be done, rather than only see the climate emergency as a security threat that needs to be trained for?" Netta Crawford suggests the U.S. military should help reduce the emergency itself and the instability it will cause. Netta Crawford said, "A much better strategy than preparing for climate change-caused war is to prevent climate change-caused war." According to Lindsay Koshgarian, program director at the National Priorities Project, federal and military budgeting priorities might also need to shift. The White House is expected to request a military budget of more than $770 billion for the next fiscal year. Lindsay Koshgarian added, "As long as we continue to push that amount of money into the military, we will not have the resources to deal with climate change." Even so, the U.S. Army Climate Strategy is considered an important document. Professor David Vine says it does reflect a long-standing concern in the U.S. military that actually has been much more progressive and advanced than most of the rest of the U.S. government about global warming and climate change. Netta Crawford added, "For example, the move to electrify army vehicles is significant in the stimulus it gives to manufacturers to produce more electric vehicles and lower their costs in the rest of the country." Richard Kidd, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Environment and Energy Resilience, claimed the Department of Defense will incorporate climate risks in its future strategies as well, including the expected National Defense Strategy, adding, "A comprehensive climate mitigation and sustainability plan will be released in the fall." However, the concern remains that these strategies will only treat the symptoms and not marginally. Although the Army Climate Strategy, ACS, highlights the need to act now, it says so four times in the document. The targets are set over another 20 years. To Lindsay Koshgarian, plans like the Army Climate Strategy prompt a bigger question. Can any military goal, such as sustained land dominance by any large military, America's or otherwise, ever be sustainable? Koshgarian notes that there is no such thing as sustainable fast fashion, and there's no such thing as sustainable global military hegemony.